This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The best river pigs were young, agile, and small, and brave. You kind of needed those skills if you were going to run out into the middle of a river, stepping on wet logs to get to where the logs were starting to jam. Then you'd use a big jab stick called a peavey to dislodge the jam and run like hell back to the safety of the shoreline before you slipped and fell into the cold water and were crushed by the weight of the rushing timber. Log drives were a big part of life on the Connecticut River in the late 1800s and early 1900s. You wouldn't necessarily know it now, and the Connecticut actually looks a lot different than it did, say, 150 years ago. Some of the most difficult stretches of river where whitewater jammed up the logs are underwater now because hydro dams that have been constructed flooded the rapids and the waterfalls of that time. But at Sumner Falls in Heartland, Vermont, you can get some idea of the dangers the rivermen came up against. From a documentary called Dynamite, Whiskey, and Wood, Ed Klikowski explains.
A site like this presents all kinds of problems. And a site like this is really dangerous. Because what happens is that as logs start getting snagged on these ledges, logs behind those start impacting. And pretty soon what you have is an enormous log jam start to build up. And these log jams start impounding water behind them, so the water pressure really starts to increase. But your job is to some way free the logs and send them downriver.
The last big log drive on the Connecticut was in 1915, 100 years ago. So today on the program, we're going to trace the history. Between April and August, 500 rivermen floated 60 million feet of wood down the river in an enterprise that was equal parts thrilling and dangerous. We'll discuss the historical, cultural, and ecological significance of the drives and the logging industry in Vermont. And we're joined today by two writers and Vermont chroniclers, Mark Bushnell and Tom Slayton. Nice to see you both back on the show. Thanks for being here.
Our pleasure.
So I know it wasn't all thrilling and all dangerous, and certainly it wasn't all romantic on these log drives. There was a lot of tedium for people who worked them as well, but I've been told it's bad form to start a program with the tedium. So let's start with the excitement and the romance. And I'm hoping that, Tom, maybe you could kick us off by just painting us a picture of what it was like, all of these people working on these log drives, sending these long logs down icy riverways from northern Vermont and heading to the sawmills and lumber yards of southern New England.
Right. Well, it was an enterprise that I can only say was in every term heroic. You can see pictures of the Connecticut River filled bank to bank in the widest part with logs. The Connecticut River is 350 miles long, and there were mills every little way, and of course different companies wanted to capture the logs for their mill. And to do that, they would go into the woods in the fall, and they would spend the winter. They would build a logging camp out of logs, and they would spend the winter there. And all winter long, they'd be chopping down trees and getting them, dragging them by horsepower usually, although later they use railroads and other things, but getting them one way or another to the bank of the river where they had these loading areas. And these were extremely dangerous as well. They'd get to the loading, they'd pile logs all winter on these loading areas, and come spring, the ice would go out of the rivers, and a rush of water would come down, and they'd roll the logs off these ramps into the river and move them downstream. And I don't know, there's the book that tells this story best, and a classic, is Tall Trees, Tough Men by Robert E. Pike. And Pike says that there was 130 million feet of spruce logs came down a section of the Wild Ammonoosuc in the late 19th century, and that had to go into the Connecticut, moving down to mills along the Ammonoosuc and then the Connecticut. These guys were rough, tough, powerful guys. They had to be to survive in the woods. And when they came out of the woods in the spring, the rivermen were the elite of the group. And because they did the most dangerous job, they were paid the most of any of the working guys, and they took the most chances, and they died most often.
Well, let's bring Mark in here. Mark Bushnell, when you step into that grainy black and white picture, where do you step into it?
I guess I sort of look at the rivermen as East Coast cowboys. We don't have cowboys here, but you know, and cowboys have gotten all the glamour from Hollywood. I don't know why the rivermen have been ignored comparatively. But, I mean, if you think about it, they're a group of these rough, tough men, as Tom was saying, who are bringing a product to market, you know, which doesn't sound that glamorous. But along the way, there are these incredible dangers, the icy water, the incredibly heavy and fast-moving logs, the rocks in the way, and drowning. I'm not even sure how well any of these men would be able to swim. Especially in those cold waters. But, I mean, a whole mystique grew up about it. There, the book that Tom mentioned, Tall Trees and Tough Men.
Which I should say for our radio audience here, both of you have brought your own copies with you.
It's got an entire chapter on the ballads of, you know, that grew up about the rivermen. I mean, I don't think any of them are you know, chart-topping hits, but...
Tom, I got a note that you had ballads you wanted to talk about, but the note I got said you won't sing them.
Yeah, I promise not to sing them. There's one, probably the most famous, was called The Jam on Jerry's Rocks. It was not raspberry jam. It was a log jam, and it contains, it tells the story of the death of the foreman of the river crew, a man identified as their foreman, Young Monroe. And let me just read one quick verse. We had not picked up many a log till Monroe, he did say, "I'll have you boys be on your guard. The jam will soon give way." He had no more spoke the words when the jam did break and go, and with it went those six brave men and foreman Young Monroe. And they go down river 10 miles. And in some versions of the song, they find his head, and in other versions, they find his body. And the way they usually found the bodies of the drowned rivermen was totally stripped of all their clothes because they'd been beat up by the logs, but their boots, which their hobnail boots, were laced on. And so they'd take the boots off and hang them on a tree. And they said there were boots hanging on trees all the way down the Connecticut River.
We actually got a question about that from Joe, who wanted to know if there was truth to the lore that when a logger died on the drive, they tied his boots together and hung it from a tree near where he died. And that's true, Tom.
That's absolutely true. And there's a picture of such a memorial in Tall Trees, Tough Men.
We're talking about the river drives today. A generation ago, a lot of Vermonters may still have remembered the log drives of the late 1800s and early 1900s. Kids say they used to run down to the water and stand by the water's edge. Sometimes the cook would give them treats or donuts that the cook had made. And in some places, the drive actually stopped mill work for a time because the mills were using water resources, places like Bellows Falls. And so the weeks when the log drives came through, the mills would stop working, and those were lean weeks for families who relied on mill work to be paid and to get their food and clothing, because you know all the mill workers would be laid off for those weeks until the log drive was gone. So listeners, if you remember family stories that have been passed down to you, you can share them with us. We're learning about the history and the lore of the log drives on the Connecticut River, but they happened elsewhere in our region as well. So if you have a thought or a story to share, or even just a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Mark, when did the log drives actually become a standard way of getting timber from the forests to the sawmills?
Well, I've seen references as old as from the 1760s. I mean, these aren't the long log drives, which everyone wrote ballads about, were these 20-foot each log would be about 20 feet, and there'd be hundreds of thousands or millions of them in the river. These were just a few very select, even larger trees. These were white pines that were cut for use by the British Navy as masts. And what they were looking for was trees that were at least 24 inches in diameter and usually 80 to 150 feet in height, so quite massive trees. There was a guy in a Connecticut lumberjack who had contracted to deliver 80 mass-size white pines to the take them down the Connecticut River for the British. And in 1761, he cut and floated 147 of them, and fewer than 80 actually made the trip in one piece because they got smashed to bits, or they were considered not up to snuff when they got to the end. So he actually had to cut more the next year to complete the contract, and it took 3 years before those logs even ended up back in England. There actually was British law that you weren't allowed to cut trees that were more than 24 inches in diameter, because those were, you know, the king's property. And you know, and if you're going to have a colony, what's the point of having a colony if you can't
use the resources? Right.
Exactly. and there's actually a case of a guy in 1761 who got caught with 16 large pines that he claimed he was just clearing a meadow. And it's like, oh, they just happened to be in the way. He was fined 800 pounds and jailed for several months.
Wow. So there's evidence that that logs were being transported down these big rivers and down the Connecticut as early as the 1760s. But when did it become popular to have these big drives that were really sort of economic fuel for this industry? Tom, you're raising your fingers.
Yeah. I think it was – they were in northern New England, in our part of the world, they became prominent around the middle of the 19th century, and they continued until the early 20th century. And the celebration in Barnett?
Yeah, Barnett on August 1st.
August 1st is celebrating the last major log drive on the Connecticut, which took place in 1915, 100 years ago.
We got a note from the Barnett Historical Society who says, yes, Barnett is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the last log drive on August 1st from 10 to 4 at the Maplemont Farm on Route 5. There are going to be displays, readings, lumberjack exhibitions, music, food, and more. And at least 5 historical societies from towns along the Connecticut will be on hand with information and displays. We actually have a link to that on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net if you're interested in going. And let's go to Rob, who's calling in now from Johnson. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
I was fortunate enough to be mentored by two river drivers in the mid-70s. I was in Maine, and I just always reflect back on the sparkle in their eye when they talked about going on the river drives. It was obviously a great time in their life, and that's my comment. It just must have been exciting for them all.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Mark and Tom, who were the people who said, this is the job for me? I mean, what kind of job was this? Was this something that parents were proud if their sons were doing, or was this dangerous work that was sort of a last resort for blue-collar workers?
Well, there's a couple of ways of answering that question. One is the general mass of lumberjacks came off the farm. But as time went on, people became more specialized, and people got really good at being river drivers. And as your caller said, they reminisced over it and remembered it as an exciting, wonderful time, even though some of their friends were killed and it was dangerous. The log drives were the major way of getting timber from the woods to the mill for 100 years, roughly. And the lumbermen, the rivermen, they said, were born. They were not made. They were born. And there's stories told about rivermen as boys scrambling over logs in the mill pond, in the local mill pond, falling in, being fished out numerous times until they get the knack of how to balance on a log and how to burl a log, which is to roll it. And some of the lumberjack festivals that happen in this area now, you see burling contests with guys who still know this skill opposing one another and trying to toss the other off into the river.
Mark, there was sort of a hierarchy, as Tom mentioned. These rivermen, they were really the elite here, these guys who would actually walk out onto the logs and help get the logs corralled where they should be going, or break up a jam with those long sticks, the peavies that they would use to try to break up the logs. But there were a lot of other people who were sort of assisting in this effort as well. In fact, there were wagons that would have to follow the logs down the river. They'd be on land. Can you describe what kind of setup there was?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like what the what the cowboys had, in a sense. I mean, they even had a chuck wagon following them. And I think Tom made reference to, you know, needing horses to drag them, the logs to the river. And so there were teamsters and, you know, blacksmiths and, you know, a clerk to keep things in order. And actually at the very top was the camp boss, who sort of – I'm sure the boss had a boss, but was the one not to be reckoned – you know, I mean, the one you had to reckon with.
Yeah.
I mean, they talk about these fights people would get into. There was one I forget his name, a famous and feared river boss who needed to go check something down downstream, and they were up way near, I think it was Beecher's Falls, and
yeah.
he said, stay away, you know, men keep working, you know, stay away from the saloon. And it was cold, dreary spring day, and, you know, the guys gravitated to the saloon, and he came in and just basically tore the place apart and got them, you know, gave... Got the men to have the fear of God, or at least the fear of him, to get back to work. Well, they talked about these incredible fights these guys would have. And, you know, they're portrayed as sort of as a lark, you know, these brawls. And the men, in addition to the PV, they wore caulk boots, which are boots with one-inch spikes on them, which are really handy for rolling logs. And they also were pretty handy in a fight. And they would leave marks that they referred to as lumberjack smallpox because of all the little welts you would get.
Ugh, yeah, sometimes yeah. on your face even.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like fun to me, but it was a special breed.
The guy you're referring to was named Jigger Johnson, Albert Jigger Johnson.
Which one?
The camp boss who cleaned out the bar. And according to the story in Tall Trees, Tough Men, after he was throwing men out, and he was interrupting the business of the bar, so the bouncer came over and attacked him. And stomped on his face with his hobnail boots. And so Johnson grabbed the man around the legs, picked him up bodily, even though Johnson was only 5'6", and set him on the hot wood stove and held him there, and then pulled a lamp down from the ceiling, kerosene lamp, crashed it over his head so the guy's ablaze, threw him out into the snow where his friends threw a blanket over him. It was an incredibly violent, violent world. And this was like... they'd come out of the woods after a year of being isolated, without booze, without women, without really good food, and they'd tear a town apart.
Yeah, so I mean, and should be said that towns either benefited or in some cases saw the downside of this industry as people would come through, because the towns would have saloons, the towns might have prostitutes who live nearby, the towns might also just be able to give supplies to these people who were coming through.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
I think that the towns that felt both the economic boom and the downside were the ones at the end of the drive.
Mm-hmm.
When
the men had a break.
When they had money. They got paid at the end.
Yeah.
Because you hear a lot of stories about this, the arrival of the log drive being sort of a community event, because it would roll like thunder. You would hear the logs coming and people would come down to the river. And as you mentioned, the kids would go and pester the cook and maybe get a treat. And apparently on Sundays, people would go and join the loggers for a potluck dinner.
Huh.
Which probably made them feel a little bit the community a little bit better about being thrown out of work.
Woodsville, New Hampshire, where the Androscoggin comes into the Connecticut, was a place where these guys got paid and so blew off steam. And the Woodsville News back in the 19th century, every April and May had court news that was just full of brawls and beatings and so forth. And there was one story that stuck with me. It said that four loggers were killed. This is the Woodsville News. Four loggers were killed by exploding dynamite, which they were trying to thaw over a campfire.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. And dynamite, we should say, often used to break up the jams when the men couldn't
exactly
break it up.
Right.
Let's go to Larry, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I was fortunate enough to get to see the last log drive in Maine on the Kennebec River in 1976. And
wow.
It was just a sight to behold. It was amazing to see virtually no water on the river, just logs. And it almost looked like a corduroy road had been built over it. And I was able to get down close to the logs and the water and thought about trying to walk on top of them and realized that if I fell through, I was going to be in a lot of trouble. So I opted not to do that, but it was amazing to see.
Larry, was that a destination for you? Did you go on purpose, or did you just happen to be in the right place at the right time?
I happened to be at the right place in the right time. I took a back road to try to get to Quebec City when I first moved here from Louisiana, and just happened to stumble upon it. It was amazing to see.
Wow, Larry, thanks for calling. I really appreciate that. Amazing to see that last drive on the Kennebec in 76. Sally emailed in to say, my grandfather was one of the elite river loggers in New Hampshire in the early 1900s. He was a big, burly man with a thirst for adventure. He had excellent balance, and he never had learned how to swim. He was very good at it, but it terrified him. He got into it because of the camaraderie and the good pay, especially since he didn't have a good education. He worked on the Amonoosuc and the Androscoggin rivers mostly. I still have his PV, she says, and his hobnail boots. Oh, Sally, that's very cool. We are following the history of the big log drives that were a hallmark of river life on the Connecticut River in the late 18 and early 1900s. Last major drive on the Connecticut was 100 years ago this year. If you have a story to tell or a question about what the log drives were like, please send us a note. You can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Coming up, how to make things easier for the log drives. Well, it hasn't necessarily made things easier for people who still live along the river. There were a lot of ways that they tried to make the rivers better for logs, not necessarily the right way that the river wants to flow, and not so great for those of us who've experienced floods since the rivers were straightened. We're going to hear a little bit more about that, and you're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're learning more about the longstanding tradition of driving logs from the wild forests up north to the lumber yards and sawmills in southern New England. The last major log drive on the Connecticut River was 100 years ago this summer. Writers Tom Slayton and Mark Bushnell are sharing their knowledge and stories with us. And you can ask a question or chime in with your own family history. Maybe your parents or grandparents remember being treated to donuts from the camp cook at those log drives passed by your town, or maybe, as Sally, who just wrote to us, told, you actually still have some of the remnants of the riverman's life. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or share a comment with us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Before we get to a few more of your stories, there are some lasting reminders of our log driving history in Vermont and New Hampshire, and one of them is an environmental impact that has come back to haunt us as we've seen more flooding in recent years. We turn now to another writer, Nat Tripp, who's also a former Connecticut River commissioner. Nat, nice to have you on the program again.
Oh, my pleasure. Great show.
Thanks. It's really fun to hear these stories. So the aim of the log drives was to move all of this timber as quickly and safely as possible with as little loss as possible, and certainly as little loss of human life, but probably more importantly to the companies, as little loss of wood as possible. And the river was the conduit. So making the river the best possible conduit was in the best interest of these companies. And how did they do that? How did they try to work the river to their advantage?
Yeah, well, that's right. They wanted that river just to be a sluice, just as straight as they could make it. And they did two things. One of them was called desnagging, which was to remove any of the woody debris in the river that logs might get hung up on. They would dynamite any rock outcroppings that might impede the flow and rocks could get hung up on. But the third thing they did, which we are still feeling the effects of, was to straighten out the oxbows or meanders wherever they could. A river, when it flows across a floodplain where there isn't much gradient, always starts to meander back and forth in those lovely, graceful S-shaped curves. And you can see them from an airplane over rivers that are doing this, and you can certainly see it on the upper Connecticut. And logs would tend to get caught in those curves. So in the summertime, when the other work was done, they would have crews with teams of horses canalizing the river, eliminating those oxbows to get it to run as quickly as possible. And we're still paying for that, because the river has been trying to get back to that original course over the next 100 years. It's still doing it now, whereas some of the other things that happened, like the degradation of water quality, the river recovered from that, but it's still trying to regain its old channel.
Can you give us any examples of places where you're actually seeing that, where the oxbow was removed and now you can see the river trying to meander once again?
Absolutely. The best example is right above the town of Guildhall in Vermont, an area that we call the Maidstone Bends. And that was very problematic in those days because the meanders were quite pronounced. And it's extremely problematic today because the river is, it's a big area where it's eroding a cemetery over on the New Hampshire side. And farther upstream, there's an industrial park where the river is trying to reclaim what was originally belonged to the river. And all along the river, wherever you have those oxbows, the farmers are trying to remedy it by short-term solutions, dumping riprap in the river to keep it from eroding their fields. But really, those don't work very well. The river is much bigger than anything you can put in it. And it wants to get back to its original course.
Nat, what about the way that they used to take debris and snags out of the river? Because obviously you didn't want your logs to get caught on anything. Has that affected the river ecosystem to have been sort of clear channeled in that way?
Absolutely. For one thing, it eliminates habitat, as any trout fisherman will tell you. The habitat that's created by snags or debris in a river is very important. And you don't want something that's just like a gutter flowing straight and smooth. Also, those the oxbows as well as the debris and snags slowed the river down. So the flooding, the periodic flooding of the river was really exacerbated by these measures, not to mention the clear cutting upstream in the watershed, too. That made the flooding and sedimentation much worse.
Nat Tripp is an author and a former Connecticut River Commissioner. Nat, what a pleasure to talk with you again. Thanks for being on the show.
Yep, thank you.
We're talking about log drives today. We're talking about the history of log drives that went through our region, and we've got a lot of you with stories to tell. You can add your own. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page or write to us. Our email is vermontedition@vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Duncan in Waterbury Center. Hi, Duncan. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
So I wanted to tell you, 40 years ago, I went fishing with my father, and our fishing guide was an elderly gentleman about 75 years old who had spent most of his life in log drives, and he told us three stories that stand out very briefly. One was in the wintertime, they used to sleep on the snow, and they would spread out this very large tin sheet, and it would reflect the heat of the fire that they would start. And he said it was always tricky because you didn't want to freeze to death, but you didn't want to get too close because it would set your boots or your whatever you were sleeping on fire. Secondly, during Prohibition, he said that they didn't have any alcohol, so they used to drink lemon extract. And, of course, loggers being loggers, they turned it into alcohol. And he said, I could have made a lemon pie as big as this room, and I never could drink anything lemon after that. And lastly, he said, whenever the loggers, unfortunately, fell beneath the logs when they were trying to break up a jam, what they would do as a memorial is they would take their boots and they would nail them to a tree. And he said, on some rivers, you could go down and you could see quite a few boots on the trees as you're going down the river.
Duncan, thanks so much for calling in. What great stories to have from your fishing guide. Let's go to Fritz in Waterbury Center. Hi, Fritz. Your thoughts?
Hi.
Hi.
Apropos of a caller, a couple of calls ago, who mentioned he'd seen the last river drive in Maine. I thought you might be interested to know I worked on that drive back in 1965 and 66 for those two summers.
Wow. What was it like, Fritz? You know, we've been talking about this. Now we're talking to somebody who knows firsthand.
Oh, it was pretty exciting. I mean, it wasn't a log drive. I mean, it wasn't a long log drive. It was all pulp. By that time, there was only one long log drive, which took place up in St. John's River. And I could never get onto that because I was going to university. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. I've got lots of good memories. I worked on a dam most of the time, and we used to sluice anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 quarts a night.
Wow, Fritz, wow. Thanks for calling in. What memories and what a great resource you are for people who want to learn more about the log drives. One more in here before we come back to our guests. Alton is calling in from Walcott. Hi, Alton, go ahead.
Hello. I grew up on the St. Croix River and the boundary between Maine and New Brunswick. and they would have a crew made up of half Canadians and half Americans. And at the time, like your previous caller said, there was mostly pulpwood that was coming down. And they'd bring it down the lake by putting them in what they call boom logs. These logs were probably 20 feet long, and they'd be chained together on the end. And in the middle of these logs, they'd put a lot of pulpwood, which is only 4 feet long. And every year, they'd go down to clear the pulpwood out of the bays and whatnot, to the various places it would hang up. But the big one that I remember, and I was never able to go on it because I was too young. You had to be 16, and I didn't make it. But I watched them come down when they took the chains out of all of the boom logs and let those go down. And there were guys there that could still do the burling, and they'd go down through this white water. I still, to this day, don't know how they did it. But they'd stay on these logs going down through the white water and stay on top of them.
Wow. Alton, what a cool thing to have seen. That's really fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. Tom, Mark, great to hear some stories of people who, I mean, like Fritz actually worked on the log drives, the pulp drives in the 60s, and other people who remember seeing them because, you know, as we've been saying, the last really big drive on the Connecticut was in 1915, but that wasn't the end of log drives in general. It was sort of the end of that end of an era, but it petered out, you know, through the 50s and 60s, and other kinds of smaller drives were still happening. In the time we have left, I'd love to hear, you know, you guys have stories, you have people to talk about, but what's one thing that you feel like, Mark, you really want to just highlight in this discussion?
Yeah, actually, it's not an individual. It's more an image. Tom was talking earlier at the beginning of the show about these photographs you can still see of the log drives where it was just log, 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 you know, totally choking the Connecticut River at its widest spot. That log drive in 1915, there was a newspaper report that when the first logs had reached Bellows Falls, the back of it was at Barnett, which if you get out a map, that's 80 river miles. So there were a lot of people out of work waiting for their mill, you know, to reopen and just a whole stretch of the river that was totally taken over by this one industry.
Yeah, 80 miles worth of logs at one time. That's pretty impressive. Tom, your thoughts?
Well, my last thoughts are that a memory of my own of skiing before the Mount Mansfield Touring Center was in operation, skiing into the Ranch Valley. And it was called the Ranch Valley because before the ski area came in, well before, there was a logging camp there called Ranch Camp run by a man named Craig Burt. And a friend and I skied in before the ski area was there. We skied in over logging roads, which is what several of the trails are now on.
So this is like the Stowe area you're thinking
of?
Yeah,
it's in Stowe. And it's called the Ranch Valley. You skied in, and this logging camp was still there. We poked our heads in. It was kind of a dark and dank, not too attractive place, and they eventually tore it down. But it had a double significance because it was important in the early history of skiing as well. Because after the logging ended, Craig Burt had a son who liked to ski, and his son, he turned the camp into a ski camp.
So just one small piece there of the legacy of these log drives that you still see reminders of, as we heard from Nat Tripp and in other ways, and still people who remember being a part of them. Authors Tom Slayton and Mark Bushnell, thank you so much for being on the program. What a way to bring it all to life. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Glad to be here.
Several months ago, we told you about a homebrew competition that was going to give one local beer maker the chance to sell to the masses and see if he or she could make the cut. Coming up next on Vermont Edition, we'll talk to the winner. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When tickets went on sale for the Vermont Brewers Festival a few months ago, they sold out in minutes. All that pent-up excitement for beer was released at the Burlington Waterfront this past weekend. And among the many, many beers on tap at the festival was a homebrew voted best in the state. It was the winner of a competition to give an amateur Vermont homebrewer the chance to sell their beer to the masses. We talked with Jason Dennis at the Winooski Beverage Warehouse in January, back when the competition was announced.
We're always at the Beverage Warehouse, surrounded by beer and people that love beer. And, you know, we see that look in people's eyes that wonder, well, geez, I wonder if I could do that. You know, do I have what it takes to do something like this?
So Beverage Warehouse and 14th Star Brewing in St. Albans came up with the Make the Cut competition. It gave the winner a limited distribution deal to bars and stores around the state and the honor of pouring beer at this weekend's Brewers Festival. Well, that winner is Brett Seymour of Warren, and he's on the line with us now. Brett, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks.
So your beer, your winning beer, is a Schwartz beer. What did you name it?
It's called Salute Your Schwartz.
Why?
It's a reference to the old Nickelodeon television show, Salute Your Shorts.
Uh-huh.
I grew up watching it, and I love it. And I love a good pun.
Although I understand you got a lot of pressure to use a Spaceballs reference.
Yeah, a lot of people were saying it had to be a Spaceballs reference, but that just felt like low-hanging fruit, so.
Because the famous Spaceballs line is...
May the Schwartz be with you, or my Schwartz is bigger than
yeah,
yours.
May the Schwartz be with you. So, so beyond the great references that you can have, obviously, for the title of a beer, can you tell Luddites out there what a Schwartz beer is?
Schwartz beer is a traditional dark lager from Germany. It's Schwartz actually means black, so it just means black beer. But it's got all the dark characters, like all the dark malt characters that you would want in a darker beer, but since it's a lager, it drinks a lot lighter and smooth. The color is deceptive.
So the color is dark. It is a black beer, a Schwartz beer, but
yes.
But if I drank it, I would taste more of a lager on my tongue?
Well, you would still be tasting the chocolatey notes, a little bit of roastiness, a bit of smokiness, but it would drink more like a lager. It's light. It's 4.9% ABV, so it's lighter and smooth, and it's a lot easier to drink than people think.
You know, Brett, there are a lot of double IPAs and specialty IPAs, the India Pale Ale out there. Really hoppy beers seem to be on trend right now. How come you wanted to diverge from that a little bit?
I don't get me wrong, I like hoppy beer, but I'm tired of going to the bar or to a store, and the only thing I ever see are 8% hoppy beers. You know, there's other stuff out there. A lot of times you go into a place that they don't have that many taps, and all you can get are hoppy beers, and sometimes you want something with a little bit of malt backbone, not so many hops. So I just wanted to do something different than what was generally out there.
So is there any special method to really sort of putting the malt forward in a beer like yours?
Use less hops.
That's it? That's the only trick?
Well, you know, it depends on what kind of malty beer you're going for. There's so many different types of malts out there, just like there's so many different types of hops out there, and you can really, you know, you can mix them to make just the right combination, and then you just back off on the hops a little and let the malt or the yeast do the talking.
So you were obviously at the Brewers Festival this past weekend. I understand it was a busy, sort of sleep-deprived weekend for you, and you got to serve your beer at the 14 Star Brewing 10. What kind of reception did you get from people who were trying it?
Everything, at least to my face, was very good. People seemed to really enjoy it. A few people came back multiple times for it.
Oh, well, that's a good sign.
Yeah, that felt pretty good.
And how much did you get to sell?
At the Brewers Fest?
At the Brewers Fest.
At the Brewers Fest, I know we went through probably a couple kegs at least. I'm not sure exactly how many.
Well, and my understanding of the competition, this Make the Cut competition that you won, is that it made it possible for you to brew 60 barrels that were distributed in 16-ounce four-packs around the state. And Salute Your Schwartz is already sold out in some places. It's a hard thing to get your hands on, I understand.
Yeah, I was just talking to, I bumped into a Feral distributor, and he said they're already out of it. So that's crazy. I mean, it's really cool, but I know a lot of people that are a little bummed. But that just means it's out at the distributor, so it's still around in places.
All right, so people can find it. Any tips on where you think people should go?
Well, I know for sure it's on tap at the Smokehouse in the Mad River Valley. And there's a few four-packs left at the Village Grocery here, too, in Waitsfield. I'm not sure where else there's it's on tap. I'm not sure. I didn't get the full list.
And any chance you're going to continue brewing it?
I would love to. It's a little tricky. These things kind of take time, but a few people have talked to me about getting something done. So
really, the trick is make friends with Brett Seymour if you want to try the Schwartz beer.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really have a good setup to lager beer during the summer, but perhaps I'll be making some more this winter.
Well, you've been homebrewing for 7 years. This is not your day job, but why not go pro now? You just won this big competition.
Yeah, I've had a few people contact me about that, but these things take time, so we'll see where it all goes.
Brett Seymour of Warren is the winner of the Make the Cut competition with his Schwartz beer. The competition was sponsored by Winooski Beverage Warehouse and 14th Star Brewing Company in St. Albans to choose the best homebrew in the state and put it on the market commercially. You may still be able to get some if you are very, very lucky. Brett Seymour, congratulations and thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, nothing says summer quite like a good ghost story. But what could be worse than sitting around a campfire, having your turn come up to spin a tale, and drawing a blank? Or worse, telling a story that just isn't scary. Well, never fear. This week in Vermont Edition's Summer School, we're getting some tips on crafting the perfect spooky tale. Thea Lewis is the founder of Burlington's Queen City Ghost Walk. She's also written about hauntings and history, and she's been called Vermont's Queen of Halloween.
It's not too tough to tell a ghost story. There are certain elements that people need to be mindful of. The best ghost stories have an element of surprise, an element of tragedy, but also the best ghost stories sound familiar, and whether or not you've created it as a work of fiction or it's a ghost story that's steeped in history, it's best if the people you're telling it to feel a connection to it and feel like it's real. It's a friend of yours or a cousin of yours. They've got a name. They come from a place. You generally want to make sure when you're telling a ghost story that the young girl is attractive or has some type of attractive trait. A ghost story needs a kicker, something that's going to make your listener really stand up and take notice. A guy I used to date named Danny grew up in a small town about 50 miles from here. He had a best friend named Kyle. They went through school together. After they graduated, neither one of them could find a job. The economy was just so depressed. So they ended up back in their hometown, working at the soap factory. On Friday nights, they'd leave their second shift job, and they'd head to a little dive bar at the end of town. They'd play pool and drink. Well, Danny told me that one night, they were drinking at this bar, when he noticed a young woman sitting at the end of the bar nursing a gin and tonic. He said she had blonde hair swept up in a ponytail. She was wearing a little pearl necklace. He talked to her for a while and discovered that she'd been left there by some friends. Well, he told her that he and Kyle wouldn't mind giving her a ride back to town. So, a little while later, there they go crunching across the gravel parking lot to Kyle's car. And Danny noticed that Lizzie looked cold. She wasn't wearing a jacket. So he gave her his. Well, they rode for a while. And they got to the address she'd given them, and she hopped out of the car almost as though she was a little embarrassed and went running up the front steps. When she got to the door, she turned around before she went in and gave them a wave goodbye. Well, they got about 2 minutes away before Danny remembered his jacket. Well, Kyle was cursing and laughing. He turned the car around, and they went back. Danny went up to the door and knocked. It took a couple minutes for the lights to come on. And then this elderly woman came to the door wearing a bathrobe. Danny told her he was looking for Lizzie and that she had his jacket. The woman's face softened a little bit and she invited him inside. After she turned on the living room light, she brought him over to a little table with a photo, and it was Lizzie wearing the same pearl necklace she'd been wearing earlier in the evening. The woman said, "Lizzie is my daughter. She died 30 years ago on a night just like this. Ever since then, on rainy October nights, she finds a way to make her way home. Lizzie is buried in St. John's Cemetery. It's about a mile from here." Well, Danny couldn't figure out what to do. He was just beside himself, so he said goodnight and he left. He got in the car and told Kyle the old woman's story. Kyle said, well, here we go. St. John's Cemetery, is it? And they took off. They got there, got out of the car, and they went through the cemetery gate, down to the third row, the wind blustery overhead. They shone the flashlight on all the headstones, and they found it. Lizzie O'Brien. Danny looked down, and there, on top of the grave, was his jacket.
Well, there you have it. Not just some tips from Thea Lewis, but an actual ghost tale to get you really inspired. That was produced by VPR's Sam Gale Rosen. Next Monday in summer school, we'll learn how to catch night crawlers. Be here tomorrow, too, when we'll talk about how we understand our own internal biases when it comes to race. A new study by a UVM researcher looks at how aware or unaware white individuals are about their own subtle behaviors and perceptions when it comes to interacting with people of color. Join us to learn more about that study tomorrow on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.